third category was any territory which member states might voluntarily wish to transfer to trusteeship. So I'm not aware of any reluctance for security reasons. Mm-hmm.
There's the question I'd like to ask you about, Yalta. As you indicated, one thing that was not agreed at Dumbarton Oaks was the question of voting. And by the time you got to Yalta, there was a British-American compromise, I think, proposal, which the Russians eventually agreed to. But my question is, the three heads of delegation, Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin, was it your impression they really understood the distinction between a veto on certain cases and non-applicability of the veto in other cases?
Oh, very definitely. And you see, a demonstration of that came up at San Francisco, because we had insisted that no power could veto discussion or presentation of the case. And Molotov, as I mentioned in my book, backtracked from what had been agreed at Yalta, which might indicate he didn't understand. But since Stalin immediately countermanded Molotov when Hopkins flew over to take care of that point, I think it's more that Molotov was just so angered by the decision to admit Argentina, when that was contrary to the Yalta agreement, the agreements of Yalta, that I think it was just mulishly going to refuse to agree to something, sort of a tit for tat. But the fact that Hopkins had no trouble when he stated the issue, Stalin understood it immediately and said, of course. And we can see him on the top as instructed.
Stalin agreed to the two things, didn't he, with Hopkins that were in dispute, still in San Francisco?
Which was the other?
The other was the Argentina.
That I didn't know.
I believe so.
That,
from the records I have read.
That I don't know. Yeah.
But the United States had not favored Argentina's entrance. It was the Latin American country.
As I say in my book,
yeah,
it was a ploy that Nelson Rockefeller pulled off. And the Latin American countries obviously did want it. I don't think it was just that Nelson wanted it personally, but to solidify his standing with Latin America because of the Rockefeller interest in Latin America. I think there's no doubt he was serving personal interest. He, without informing the American delegation, including, as far as I'm aware, any member of the American delegation or the secretary, I didn't know. Stettinius didn't. Certainly, Vandenberg and Conlon didn't. And suddenly the vote was called, and it had all been arranged behind the scenes.
Incredible. Although it's happened since then in other cases.
Yes.
Mr. Gates, I'd like to move on now to San Francisco, if we could.
How about Yalta?
Is there another point you want to make with regard to Yalta?
Are you interested in how the Russians got to three votes in Yalta?
I am interested, yes, indeed.
But I don't know how often it's been written up. It's in my...
Well, that's... it's not in detail in your book. Now, why don't you go ahead and speak to that, Yalta?
I have said that the Dumbarton Oaks suggestion by Russians was for 16. By the time we got to Yalta, as we'd anticipated, Grutnikov had worked on that. And they were asking for four. Lithuania and the three that finally did come in. They only got by on Russia and the Ukraine.
Plus the Soviet Union.
And the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
But initially, maybe they were only asking. Anyway, soon they were down to three. Lithuania, which is of interest, now showing the president of Lithuania's interest in independence. It shows that Stalin was well aware of pressures at the time. It had been narrowed to those three, and the United States position was absolutely not that they were constituent parts of the Soviet Union and were not sovereign states. But each time that the point was brought up, our objections made, and the British went along with us, the Russians would say, ironically, and what about India?
Yeah.
And it was clear that the British felt that India had to be admitted to membership, whatever the dubiety of its sovereign status. It was institutionally essential. At a meeting, I can't give you the exact date, but at one of the meetings in the morning, as you know, we met in the morning with the foreign ministers and then plenary sessions with the heads of government in the afternoon. At one of the morning sessions held, I think, in the British dacha, the same rigmarole had been gone through. But since I was responsible for the minutes, from the American point of view, each delegation wrote the minutes of the foreign minister sessions held in its quarters. We did it when we met at Livadia, the British in their document. And this was the British responsibility, as I remember. And it was my duty to read the minutes as soon as they had been prepared, see that they were correct. And to my surprise, I saw that the minutes said that agreement had been reached, that the Russians would have, that votes would be given to the Ukraine, White Russia. So I rushed up to Eaton and said, "Mr. Eaton, it's a mistake. You didn't agree." And he, quite testily, which wasn't his usual manner, said, "You don't know what's happened. Speak to Ed." And I went to Mr. Timmis, and he sort of threw up his hands and said that after the meeting, and it was a substantial agreement on many matters, he had reported to Roosevelt, as he usually did, and it started by saying, "Mr. President, we agreed." It was a marvelous meeting, general agreement. And at that moment, Bowen brought Stalin in for a personal call on Roosevelt. Not a negotiating call, but really just a call of courtesy. And Roosevelt, in his expansive way, said, "Marshal Stalin, I'm just getting a report from my secretaries, my foreign minister, that at the morning meeting it was agreement on everything." And Sitting started to grab, he told me that Roosevelt sleep, and Stalin came back quickly. "On the three republics too," Roosevelt said, "everything." So the fat was in the fire. And, I think we would have agreed eventually. What difference did it make in the Senate? It was clear that Russians wanted something to make up for the fact that we were sure that the 20 Latin American states and Canada would usually vote with us. And the British had the Commonwealth to vote with them. And it was a matter of some pride. But this was, in fact, the way it happened. And it had something to do with the bad press, which quite soon the UN began to get, because Ed Flynn, as you know, was on the American delegation. participated in none of the meetings. It was he and Mrs. Flynn were in the suite upstairs at the Vatican House, and quite bored. Occasionally one of us would be sent up to report to him on what was happening, but that was just a courtesy. Flynn immediately got into the act when he heard about this, and Burns, who had no real function, had just been brought along because he was an important political figure, had no real function at Yalta, also got the wind up, and the two of them said to Roosevelt, this can interfere with the approval of the charter by the Senate. And Flynn in particular said, quite inaccurately, this is why the League didn't get through, because the British were being given 5 votes. Well, this was an Irish point of view, perhaps. But in any event, Roosevelt, who didn't like dissension, did his best to somehow minimize what they thought was a threat. And at one point, I think he suggested giving the Russians, he said, let's tell him it was a mistake. And Bolton said, oh no, this is much too serious. This will upset everything. We have told him to do it. Then I think he said, jokingly, we'll give him a battleship and take it back. He did at one point ask if the United States could have votes for Hawaii and Alaska. And Stalin, of course, said, sure, which was impossible in our constitutional arrangement. But it was softened down so that it was not put in the communique. And the oral agreement was that the Russians would bring their 2 delegations to San Francisco, propose their admission, and we would agree. But it would not be announced in advance if we'd agreed. We were hardly back in Washington before that leaked out, and I've always thought Burns was leaker just to ensure his position with the press. And this caused a great deal. And how many other secret agreements were there? And Americans had been brought up because of the League to fear secret agreements anyway. But Vandenberg accepted the true explanation immediately, the magnificent. And of course said that the idea of Alaska and Hawaii nonsense. So we went forward.
But you think this did originate some of the impressions that there were secret agreements at Yalta?
Definitely.
Yeah. Ms. Pierce, are there other things about Yalta that you think might be worth mentioning?
Well, I do think it's important, particularly at this time of thawing of the Cold War, that, as I've said in my book, the spirit of Yalta was extraordinarily congenial, and I tried to spell out why I thought so. Partly it was a military necessity, but partly there was genuine agreement on the principles of the UN. And I believe that it was possible, despite the real policy differences between the British and the U.S. on one side and the Russians on the other, to have a cooperative arrangement. And Stalin and Churchill continually referring to that. But that was not just rhetoric. And everything I have learned in the last few years confirms that. That it wasn't until the atom bomb gave Truman and Burns a feeling of invincibility. And Truman was always quite strongly anti-Soviet. You are aware of the fact that on June 23rd, the day after the German invasion of Russia, the New York Times carried front page article quoting Truman saying, "We should help whichever side is losing." Were you aware of that?
No.
The front page. Well, obviously it didn't take any Russian espionage to discover where Truman stood. He was then a senator. And he then had a terrible said to Molotov.
Yes. But it was your impression at Yalta that the three leaders really did believe that this new organization could contribute to peace among them
and that they could get along together.
Yeah.
Not think the atom bomb, among other things they did in the world, destroyed that possibility. We're only belatedly coming back to such a potential. Right?
Yeah, I'd like to move on now to San Francisco if we can. And before
Stettinius used to refer to himself and Rumiko and Cadogan as, he said, the spirit of Dumbarton Oaks. That shows that the cooperative spirit that I'm speaking of began well before Yalta, the summer before. So there was a reason for a time sequence of some duration which justified that view.
I wanted to return, I want to go to San Francisco, but before I forget it, I wanted to ask you one question. You had mentioned earlier Field Marshal Smuts as having perhaps had some influence on Churchill. And Smuts was in San Francisco.
Yes.
And he seems to have had considerable influence. Can you give me any of the background? Why was Field Marshal Smuts so involved in the new international organization? What was his particular interest?
I assumed at the time that everybody was trying to isolate his particular interest. His age was such that he must have believed in the League. And like Roosevelt, therefore, he must have thought of the United Nations as a successor to the League. And must have thought that what had not worked out with the League could succeed with a new organization. Now, this is hypothesis.
I have heard it said that he brought with him a draft of the charter, and that this draft was an important element in the final form that the charter took. Was that your...
I'm not familiar with that.
And I think you would be, actually, as Secretary of...
I think I'd be bound to.
I
wouldn't be a bit surprised if the draft that had been agreed to at Yalta hadn't been sent to him by the British early because of their close relations with him. But the invitation to San Francisco also included a draft of the charter. So that was the...
That was the basic. And that stemmed from the State Department, really?
Well, from
Dumbarton.
It worked on Dumbarton Oaks and at Yalta, too. Now, a trusteeship was agreed to at Yalta.
Right.
And you're aware, again, of how Churchill had first opposed it because his staff had never cleared trusteeship with him, which shows that he was too busy with other matters to pay the kind of attention to the UN proposal that Stettinius and before him Hall had. And are you interested in having me repeat the trusteeship?
Let's have the trusteeship story again, okay. Yes.
When at one of the plenary meetings, Stettinius, at Roosevelt's suggestion, read out our proposal for a trusteeship council, Churchill literally blew up and made a speech very much like his famous speech that he'd not been selected the King's first minister to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. the British were often suspicious of us. All great powers are suspicious of other great powers. So in spite of our close coordination of policy with them, as you know, we met at Yalta, at Malta, before we went on to Yalta, which was pretty evident. The collaboration between us and the Russians knew that it was usually two against one. But here, he simply exploded, and Roosevelt, who presided in all the plenary meeting, had to call a recess. And Churchill was just fuming. And at that point, Harry Hopkins said to me, "Alger, can't we forget about trusteeship? The whole conference has been jeopardized. And since this was my responsibility, that's why he consulted me." I said, "This is an essential part of the total. We really can't." And I don't think the Prime Minister really understands it. I know that we asked Eaton at Malta, had they yet cleared it with him? His approval was important. And Eaton said, "No, they hadn't had time to admit everything." So they hadn't yet. This is new. At that point, Burns came up with me. The only time Burns functioned effectively, and said, "Will you write down in plain language what the trusteeship stands for instead of this general narrative account that Stettinius was given?" And so I wrote down that the territories under trusteeship shall be the territories, the mandates of the League, territories detached from the Axis, and such other territories as any member nation may wish to place on a trusteeship. And I wrote it in longhand on a piece of foolscap. I then went with Burns up to Churchill, who was sitting at the table, as I say, still fuming. And Burns asked him to read it, and rather annoyed, he said, "What's this got to do with it?" With his soul. And Burns said, "That's what we're talking about." "Oh, that's it." But we then agreed on that text. And as I've said many times, I might have been able to improve on it if I had had time. But that language, I think, was never changed and put into the final. Charge of form. Now, at San Francisco, one thing that I do want to emphasize, as anyone that you've interviewed so far talked of the collaboration between Sobolev and Vesotsky.
No.
This, to me, is one fascinating aspects of San Francisco story. Sobolev was an able member of the Soviet delegation, whose English was very good and who served in their diplomatic corps. Pasvalsky was a white Russian who retained his fluency in Russian. Somehow, those two, you would think that there had been such suspicion between them that it would be difficult to work together. Somehow, those two established a relationship of trust, and they were the draftsmen of the Charter of San Francisco. Now, the outline had been written before. I'm talking about the specific language, which is a very important part of any treaty. And it was Pasvalsky and Sobolev who are really responsible for the form.
That's of interesting.
The Charter of Trust.
Interesting. On that subject, let me ask you another question. Virginia Gildersleeve, a member of the U.S. delegation, has claimed that she was responsible for the preamble to the charter, that she wrote it in one night because she wasn't happy with the way the charter sounded. Was that your impression? Were you aware of that at the conference?
No. I thought that Archie McLeish was responsible for it.
Was he there?
Yes. He was there.
That's an interesting historical question that will remain open, I guess.
Right.
I wanted to go on now to your position as Secretary General of the conference. And just looking back, what were the main problems you had to deal with in organizing the conference as Secretary General?
Well, it was an enormous project, as you're aware. This little booklet, which we printed at San Francisco, indicates. Have you seen this particular?
No, I have not.
See?
Uh-huh.
We knew that we would have to have interpreters and translators, a printing establishment. So the government printing office moved staff out there. We picked up type wherever we could, because San Francisco and a big Chinatown, we were able to get Chinese characters for the Chinese text that we had to print. We had a great difficulty getting interpreters, particularly simultaneous. I don't mean seriatim interpreters who were good enough to work without interrupting a speech a long time. And there's a cute story about that. Because of the problem, we had decided as the host government that English would be the working language. That was contrary to all prior diplomatic conferences where French was always at least an equal official language. But we just had not been able to get enough interpreters. At the first meeting, then of course we had to organize as we did, and there's this little book that shows committees how the conference would function, different parts of the draft charter were assigned to different commissions and committees, each of which would be working on a select part. And